about a standpoint which may perhaps differ from the way this has hitherto been treated. Whether the answer is a new one remains quite superficial and is of no importance. Its positive character must lie in its being ancient enough for us to learn to conceive the possibilities which the ancients have made ready for us. In its own most meaning, this answer tells us that concrete ontological research must begin with an investigative inquiry, which keeps within the horizon we have laid bare, and this is all that it tells us. If, then, the answer to the question of being is to provide the clues for our research, it cannot be adequate until it brings us the insight that the specific kind of being of ontology hitherto, and the vicissitudes of its inquiries, its findings, and its failures, have been necessitated in the very character of Dasein. Section 6. The task of destroying the history of ontology. All research, and not least that which operates within the range of the central question of being, is an ontical possibility of Dasein. Dasein's being finds its meaning in temporality. But temporality is also the condition which makes historicality possible as a temporal kind of being which Dasein itself possesses, regardless of whether or how Dasein is an entity in time. Historicality as a determinate character is prior to what is called history, world historical historizing. Historicality stands for the state of being that is constitutive for Dasein's historizing as such. Only on the basis of such historizing is anything like world history possible, or can anything belong historically to world history. In its factical being, any Dasein is as it already was, and it is what it already was. It is its past, whether explicitly or not. And this is so not only in that its past is, as it were, pushing itself along behind it, and that Dasein possesses what is past as a property which is still present at hand, and which sometimes has after-effects upon it. Dasein is its past in the way of its own being, which, to put it roughly, historizes out of its future on each occasion. Whatever the way of being it may have at the time, and thus with whatever understanding of being it may possess, Dasein has grown up both into and in a traditional way of interpreting itself. In terms of this, it understands itself proximally, and with a certain range, constantly. By this understanding, the possibilities of its being are disclosed and regulated. Its own past, and this always means the past of its generation, is not something which follows along after Dasein, but something which already goes ahead of it. The elemental historicality of Dasein may remain hidden from Dasein itself, but there is a way by which it can be discovered and given proper attention. Dasein can discover tradition, preserve it, and study it explicitly. The discovery of tradition and the disclosure of what it transmits and how this is transmitted can be taken hold of as a task in its own right. In this way, Dasein brings itself into the kind of being which consists in historiological inquiry and research. But historiology, or more precisely, historicity, is possible as a kind of being which the inquiring Dasein may possess only because historicality is a determining characteristic for Dasein in the very basis of its being. If this historicality remains hidden from Dasein, and as long as it so remains, Dasein is also denied the possibility of historiological inquiry, or the discovery of history. If historiology is wanting, this is not evidence against Dasein's historicality. On the contrary, as a deficient mode of this state of being, it is evidence for it. Only because it is historical can an era be unhistoriological. On the other hand, if Dasein has seized upon its latent possibility not only of making its own existence transparent to itself, but also of inquiring into the meaning of existentiality itself, that is to say, of previously inquiring into the meaning of being in general, and if by such inquiry its eyes have been opened to its own essential historicality, then one cannot fail to see that the inquiry into being, the ontico-ontological necessity of which we have already indicated, is itself characterized by historicality. The ownmost meaning of being, which belongs to the inquiry into being as an historical inquiry, gives us the assignment, Anweisung, of inquiring into the history of that inquiry itself, that is, of becoming historiological. In working out the question of being, we must heed this assignment, so that by positively making the past our own, we may bring ourselves into full possession of the ownmost possibilities of such inquiry. The question of the meaning of being must be carried through by explicating Dasein beforehand, in its temporality and historicality. The question thus brings itself to the point where it understands itself as historiological. Our preparatory interpretation of the fundamental structures of Dasein with regard to the average kind of being which is closest to it, a kind of being in which it is therefore proximally historical as well, will make manifest, however, not only that Dasein is inclined to fall back upon its world, the world in which it is, and to interpret itself in terms of that world by its reflected light, but also that Dasein simultaneously falls prey to the tradition of which it has more or less explicitly taken hold. This tradition keeps it from providing its own guidance, whether in inquiring or in choosing. This holds true, and by no means least, for that understanding which is rooted in Dasein's ownmost being, and for the possibility of developing it, namely for ontological understanding. When tradition thus becomes master, it does so in such a way that what it transmits is made so inaccessible, proximally and for the most part, that it rather becomes concealed. Tradition takes what has come down to us and delivers it over to self-evidence. It blocks our access to those primordial sources from which the categories and concepts handed down to us have been in part quite genuinely drawn. Indeed, it makes us forget that they have had such an origin and makes us suppose that the necessity of going back to these sources is something which we need not even understand. Dasein has had its historicality so thoroughly uprooted by tradition that it confines its interest to the multiformity of possible types, directions, and standpoints of philosophical activity in the most exotic and alien of cultures. And by this very interest it seeks to veil the fact that it has no ground of its own to stand on. Consequently, despite all its historiological interests and all its zeal for an interpretation which is philologically objective, sachliche, Dasein no longer understands the most elementary conditions which would alone enable it to go back to the past in a positive manner and make it productively its own. We have shown at the outset, section 1, not only that the question of the meaning of being is one that has not been attended to, and one that has been inadequately formulated, but that it has become quite forgotten in spite of all our interest in metaphysics. Greek ontology and its history, which, in their numerous filiations and distortions, determine the conceptual character of philosophy even today, prove that when Dasein understands either itself or being in general, it does so in terms of the world, and that the ontology which has thus arisen has deteriorated, verfällt, to a tradition in which it gets reduced to something self-evident, merely material for reworking as it was for Hegel. In the Middle Ages, this uprooted Greek ontology became a fixed body of doctrine. Its systematics, however, is by no means a mere joining together of traditional pieces into a single edifice. Though its basic conceptions of being have been taken over dogmatically from the Greeks, a great deal of unpretentious work has been carried on further within these limits. With the peculiar character which the scholastics gave it, Greek ontology has, in its essentials, travelled the path that leads through the Disputationes Metaphysici of Suarez to the metaphysics and transcendental philosophy of modern times, determining even the foundations and the aims of Hegel's logic. In the course of this history, certain distinctive domains of being have come into view and have served as the primary guides for subsequent problematics. The ego cogito of Descartes, the subject, the I, reason, spirit, person. But these all remain uninterrogated as to their being and its structure, in accordance with the thoroughgoing way in which the question of being has been neglected. It is rather the case that the categorical content of the traditional ontology has been carried over to these entities with corresponding formalizations and purely negative restrictions, or else dialectic has been called in for the purpose of interpreting the substantiality of the subject ontologically. If the question of being is to have its own history made transparent, then this hardened tradition must be loosened up, and the concealments which it has brought about must be dissolved. We understand this task as one in which, by taking the question of being as our clue, we are to destroy the traditional content of ancient ontology until we arrive at those primordial experiences in which we achieved our first ways of determining the nature of being, the ways which have guided us ever since. In thus demonstrating the origin of our basic ontological concepts by an investigation in which their birth certificate is displayed, we have nothing to do with a vicious relativizing of ontological standpoints. But this destruction is just as far from having the negative sense of shaking off the ontological tradition. We must, on the contrary, stake out the positive possibilities of that tradition. And this always means keeping it within its limits. These, in turn, are given factically in the way the question is formulated at the time, and in the way the possible field for investigation is thus bounded off. On its negative side, this destruction does not relate itself towards the past. Its criticism is aimed at today, and at the prevalent way of treating the history of ontology, whether it is headed towards doxography, towards intellectual history, or towards a history of problems. But to bury the past in nullity, Nichtigkeit, is not the purpose of this destruction. Its aim is positive. Its negative function remains unexpressed and indirect. The destruction of the history of ontology is essentially bound up with the way the question of being is formulated, and it is possible only within such a formulation. In the framework of our treatise, which aims at working out that question in principle, we can carry out this destruction only with regard to stages of that history which are in principle decisive. In line with the positive tendencies of this destruction, we must in the first instance raise the question whether, and to what extent, the interpretation of being and the phenomenon of time have been brought together thematically in the course of the history of ontology, and whether the problematic of temporality required for this has ever been worked out in principle, or ever could have been. The first and only person who has gone any stretch of the way towards investigating the dimension of temporality, or has even let himself be drawn hither by the coercion of the phenomena themselves, is Kant. Only when we have established the problematic of temporality can we succeed in casting light on the obscurity of his doctrine of the schematism. But this will also show us why this area is one which had to remain closed off to him in its real dimensions and in its central ontological function. Kant himself was aware that he was venturing into an area of obscurity. This schematism of our understanding as regards appearances and their mere form is an art hidden in the depths of the human soul, the true devices of which are hardly ever to be divined from nature and laid uncovered before our eyes. Here Kant shrinks back, as it were, in the face of something which must be brought to light as a theme and a principle if the expression being is to have any demonstrable meaning. In the end, those very phenomena which will be exhibited under the heading of temporality in our analysis are precisely those most covert judgments of the common reason for which Kant says it is the business of philosophers to provide an analytic. In pursuing this task of destruction with the problematic of temporality as our clue, we shall try to interpret the chapter on the schematism and the Kantian doctrine of time, taking that chapter as our point of departure. At the same time, we shall show why Kant could never achieve an insight into the problematic of temporality. There were two things that stood in his way. In the first place, he altogether neglected the problem of being, and in connection with this, he failed to provide an ontology with Dasein as its theme, or, to put this in Kantian language, to give a preliminary ontological analytic of the subjectivity of the subject. Instead of this, Kant took over Descartes' position quite dogmatically, notwithstanding all the essential respects in which he had gone beyond him. Furthermore, in spite of the fact that he was bringing the phenomenon of time back into the subject again, his analysis of it remained oriented towards the traditional way in which time had been ordinarily understood. In the long run, this kept him from working out the phenomenon of a transcendental determination of time in its own structure and function. Because of this double effect of tradition, the decisive connection between time and the I think was shrouded in utter darkness. It did not even become a problem. In taking over Descartes' ontological position, Kant made an essential omission. He failed to provide an ontology of Dasein. This omission was a decisive one in the spirit, im Sinne, of Descartes' ownmost tendencies. With the cogito sum, Descartes had claimed that he was putting philosophy on a new and firm footing. But what he left undetermined when he began in this radical way was the kind of being which belongs to the res cogitans, the thing which thinks, or more precisely, the meaning of the being of the sum. By working out the unexpressed ontological foundations of the cogito sum, we shall complete our sojourn at the second station along the path of our destructive retrospect of the history of ontology. Our interpretation will not only prove that Descartes had to neglect the question of being altogether, it will also show why he came to suppose that the absolute being certain, gewissen sein, of the cogito exempted him from raising the question of the meaning of the being which this entity possesses. Yet Descartes not only continued to neglect this, and thus to accept a completely indefinite ontological status for the res cogitans, sive mens sive animus, the thing which cognizes whether it be a mind or spirit, he regarded this entity as a fundamentum in concussum, firm foundation, and applied the medieval ontology to it in carrying through the fundamental considerations of his Meditationes. He defined the res cogitans, the thing which thinks, ontologically as an ens, entity, and in the medieval ontology the meaning of being for such an ens had been fixed by understanding it as an ens creatum, a created entity, God as ens infinitum, an infinite entity, was the ens in creatum, an entity not created. But createdness, geschaffenheit in the widest sense of something's having been produced, hergestelltheit, was an essential item in the structure of the ancient conception of being. The seemingly new beginning which Descartes proposed for philosophizing has revealed itself as the implantation of a baleful prejudice which has kept later generations from making any thematic ontological analytic of the mind, Gemütes, such as would take the question of being as a clue and would at the same time come to grips critically with the traditional ancient ontology. Everyone who is acquainted with the Middle Ages sees that Descartes is dependent upon medieval scholasticism and employs its terminology. But with this discovery, nothing is achieved philosophically as long as it remains obscure to what a profound extent the medieval ontology has influenced the way in which posterity has determined, or failed to determine, the ontological character of the res cogitans. The full extent of this cannot be estimated until both the meaning and the limitations of the ancient ontology have been exhibited in terms of an orientation directed towards the question of being. In other words, in our process of destruction, we find ourselves faced with the task of interpreting the basis of the ancient ontology in the light of the problematic of temporality. When this is done, it will be manifest that the ancient way of interpreting the being of entities is oriented towards the world or nature in the widest sense, and that it is indeed in terms of time that its understanding of being is obtained. The outward evidence for this, though of course it is merely outward evidence, is the treatment of the meaning of being as parousia or ousia, which signifies in ontologico-temporal terms presence, Anwesenheit. entities are grasped in their being as presence. This means that they are understood with regard to a definite mode of time, the present. The problematic of Greek ontology, like that of any other, must take its clues from Dasein itself. In both ordinary and philosophical usage, Dasein, man's being, is defined as zoon logon echon, as that living thing whose being is essentially determined by the potentiality for discourse. Legein, using discourse, is the clue for arriving at those structures of being which belong to the entities we encounter in addressing ourselves to anything or speaking about it. This is why the ancient ontology as developed by Plato turns into dialectic. As the ontological clue gets progressively worked out, namely in the hermeneutic of the logos, word, discourse, it becomes increasingly possible to grasp the problem of being in a more radical fashion. The dialectic, which has been a genuine philosophical embarrassment, becomes superfluous. That is why Aristotle no longer has any understanding of it, for he has put it on a more radical footing and raised it to a new level, aufhob. Legein, discourse, itself, or rather that simple awareness of something present at hand in its sheer presence at hand, which Parmenides had already taken to guide him in his own interpretation of being, has the temporal structure of a pure making present of something. Those entities which show themselves in this and for it, and which are understood as entities in the most authentic sense, thus get interpreted with regard to the present, that is, they are conceived as presence, ousia. Yet the Greeks have managed to interpret being in this way without any explicit knowledge of the clues which function here, without any acquaintance with the fundamental ontological function of time or even any understanding of it, and without any insight into the reason why this function is possible. On the contrary, they take time itself as one entity among other entities, and try to grasp it in the structure of its being, though that way of understanding being, which they have taken as their horizon, is one which is itself naively and inexplicitly oriented towards time. Within the framework in which we are about to work out the principles of the question of being, we cannot present a detailed temporal interpretation of the foundations of ancient ontology, particularly not of its loftiest and purest scientific stage, which is reached in Aristotle. Instead, we shall give an interpretation of Aristotle's essay on time, which may be chosen as providing a way of discriminating the basis and the limitations of the ancient science of being. Aristotle's essay on time is the first detailed interpretation of this phenomenon, which has come down to us. Every subsequent account of time, including Bergson's, has been essentially determined by it. When we analyze the Aristotelian conception, it will likewise become clear as we go back that the Kantian account of time operates within the structures which Aristotle has set forth. This means that Kant's basic ontological orientation remains that of the Greeks, in spite of all the distinctions which arise in a new inquiry. The question of being does not achieve its true concreteness until we have carried through the process of destroying the ontological tradition. In this way, we can fully prove that the question of the meaning of being is one that we cannot avoid, and we can demonstrate what it means to talk about restating this question. In any investigation in this field, where the thing itself is deeply veiled, one must take pains not to overestimate the results, for in such an inquiry one is constantly compelled to face the possibility of disclosing an even more primordial and more universal horizon from which we may draw the answer to the question, what is being? We can discuss such possibilities seriously and with positive results only if the question of being has been reawakened and we have arrived at a field where we can come to terms with it in a way that can be controlled. Section 7. The Phenomenological Method of Investigation. In provisionally characterizing the object which serves as the theme of our investigation, the being of entities, or the meaning of being in general, it seems that we have also delineated the method to be employed. The task of ontology is to explain being itself and to make the being of entities stand out in full relief. And the method of ontology remains questionable in the highest degree as long as we merely consult those ontologies which have come down to us historically, or other essays of that character. Since the term ontology is used in this investigation in a sense which is formally broad, any attempt to clarify the method of ontology by tracing its history is automatically ruled out. When, moreover, we use the term ontology, we're not talking about some definite philosophical discipline standing in interconnection with the others. Here, one does not have to measure up to the tasks of some discipline that has been presented beforehand. On the contrary, only in terms of the objective necessities of definite questions and the kind of treatment which the things themselves require can one develop such a discipline. With the question of the meaning of being, our investigation comes up against the fundamental question of philosophy. This is one that must be treated phenomenologically. Thus, our treatise does not subscribe to a standpoint or represent any special direction. For phenomenology is nothing of either sort, nor can it become so as long as it understands itself. The expression phenomenology signifies primarily a methodological conception. This expression does not characterize the what of the objects of philosophical research as subject matter, but rather the how of that research. The more genuinely a methodological concept is worked out and the more comprehensively it determines the principles on which a science is to be conducted, all the more primordially is it rooted in the way we come to terms with the things themselves, and the farther it is removed from what we call technical devices, though there are many such devices even in the theoretical disciplines. Thus the term phenomenology expresses a maxim which can be formulated as to the things themselves. It is opposed to all free-floating constructions and accidental findings. It is opposed to taking over any conceptions which only seem to have been demonstrated. It is opposed to those pseudo-questions which parade themselves as problems, of 10 for generations at a time. Yet this maxim, one may rejoin, is abundantly self-evident, and it expresses, moreover, the underlying principle of any scientific knowledge whatsoever. Why should anything so self-evident be taken up explicitly in giving a title to a branch of research? In point of fact, the issue here is a kind of self-evidence, which we should like to bring closer to us, so far as it is important to do so in casting light upon the procedure of our treatise. We shall expound only the preliminary conception, Vorbegriff, of phenomenology. This expression has two components, phenomenon and logos. Both of these go back to terms from the Greek phenomenon and logos. Taken superficially, the term phenomenology is formed like theology, biology, sociology, names which may be translated as science of God, science of life, science of society. This would make phenomenology the science of phenomena. We shall set forth the preliminary conception of phenomenology by characterizing what one has in mind in the term's two components, phenomenon and logos, and by establishing the meaning of the name in which these are put together. The history of the word itself, which presumably arose in the Wolffian school, is here of no significance. A. The concept of phenomenon. The Greek expression phenomenon, to which the term phenomenon goes back, is derived from the verb phainestai, which signifies to show itself. Thus, phenomenon means that which shows itself, the manifest, das, was sich zeigt, das sich zeigende, das offenbare. Phainestai itself is a middle-voiced form which comes from phaino, to bring to the light of day, to put in the light. Phaino comes from the stem pha, like phos, the light, that which is bright. In other words, that wherein something can become manifest, visible in itself. Thus, we must keep in mind that the expression phenomenon signifies that which shows itself in itself, the manifest. Accordingly, the phenomena, or phenomena, are the totality of what lies in the light of day or can be brought to the light, what the Greeks sometimes identified simply with the word entities. Now, an entity can show itself from itself, von ihm selbst her, in many ways, depending in each case on the kind of access we have to it. Indeed, it is even possible for an entity to show itself as something which in itself it is not. When it shows itself in this way, it looks like something or other. Sieht so aus wie. This kind of showing itself is what we call seeming, scheinen. Thus, in Greek too, the expression phenomenon, phenomenon, signifies that which looks like something, that which is semblant, semblance. Das Scheinbare, der Schein. Phenomenon agathon means something good, which looks like but in actuality is not what it gives itself out to be. If we are to have any further understanding of the concept of phenomenon, everything depends on our seeing how what is designated in the first signification of phenomenon, phenomenon as that which shows itself, and what is designated in the second phenomenon as semblance, are structurally interconnected. Only when the meaning of something is such that it makes a pretension of showing itself, that is, of being a phenomenon, can it show itself as something which it is not. Only then can it merely look like so-and-so. When phenomenon signifies semblance, the primordial signification, the phenomenon as the manifest, is already included as that upon which the second signification is founded. We shall allot the term phenomenon to this positive and primordial signification of phenomenon and distinguish phenomenon from semblance, which is the privative modification of phenomenon as thus defined. But what both these terms express has proximally nothing at all to do with what is called an appearance, or still less a mere appearance. This is what one is talking about when one speaks of the symptoms of a disease. Krankheitserscheinungen. Here one has in mind certain occurrences in the body which show themselves and which, in showing themselves as thus, showing themselves, indicate, indizieren, something which does not show itself. The emergence, auftreten, of such occurrences, their showing themselves, goes together with the being present at hand of disturbances which do not show themselves. Thus, appearance, as the appearance of something, does not mean showing itself. It means rather the announcing itself by, von, something which does not show itself, but which announces itself through something which does show itself. Appearing is a not showing itself. But the not we find here is by no means to be confused with the privative not, which we used in defining the structure of semblance. What appears does not show itself, and anything which thus fails to show itself is also something which can never seem. All indications, presentations, symptoms, and symbols have this basic formal structure of appearing, even though they differ among themselves. In spite of the fact that appearing is never a showing itself in the sense of phenomenon, appearing is possible only by reason of a showing itself of something. But this showing itself, which helps to make possible the appearing, is not the appearing itself. Appearing is an announcing itself, das sich melden, through something that shows itself. If one then says that with the word appearance we allude to something wherein something appears without being itself an appearance, one has not thereby defined the concept of phenomenon, one has rather presupposed it. This presupposition, however, remains concealed, for when one says this sort of thing about appearance, the expression appear gets used in two ways. That wherein something appears means that wherein something announces itself, and therefore does not show itself. And in the words rede, without being itself an appearance, appearance signifies the showing itself. But this showing itself belongs essentially to the wherein in which something announces itself. According to this, phenomena are never appearances, though, on the other hand, every appearance is dependent on phenomena. If one defines phenomenon with the aid of a conception of appearance, which is still unclear, Then everything is stood on its head, and a critique of phenomenology on this basis is surely a remarkable undertaking. So again, the expression appearance itself can have a double signification. First, appearing in the sense of announcing itself, as not showing itself, and next, that which does the announcing, das meldende selbst, that which in its showing itself indicates something which does not show itself. And finally, one can use appearing as a term for the genuine sense of phenomenon, as showing itself. If one designates these three different things as appearance, bewilderment is unavoidable. But this bewilderment is essentially increased by the fact that appearance can take on still another signification. That which does the announcing, that which in its showing itself indicates something non-manifest, may be taken as that which emerges in what is itself non-manifest, and which emanates, ausstrahlt, from it in such a way indeed that the non-manifest gets thought of as something that is essentially never manifest. When that which does the announcing is taken this way, appearance is tantamount to a bringing forth or something brought forth, but something which does not make up the real being of what brings it forth. Here we have an appearance in the sense of mere appearance. That which does the announcing and is brought forth does, of course, show itself, and in such a way that, as an emanation of what it announces, it keeps this very thing constantly veiled in itself. On the other hand, this not showing which veils is not a semblance. Kant uses the term appearance in this twofold way. According to him, appearances are, in the first place, the objects of empirical intuition. They are what shows itself in such intuition. But what thus shows itself, the phenomenon in the genuine primordial sense, is at the same time an appearance, as an emanation of something which hides itself in that appearance, an emanation which announces. Insofar as a phenomenon is constitutive for appearance, in the signification of announcing itself through something which shows itself, though such a phenomenon can privatively take the variant form of semblance, appearance too can become mere semblance. In a certain kind of lighting, someone can look as if his cheeks were flushed with red, and the redness which shows itself can be taken as an announcement of the being present at hand of a fever, which in turn indicates some disturbance in the organism. Phenomenon, the showing itself in itself, signifies a distinctive way in which something can be encountered. Appearance, on the other hand, means a reference relationship which is an entity itself, and which is such that what does the referring or the announcing can fulfill its possible function only if it shows itself in itself and is thus a phenomenon. Both appearance and semblance are founded upon the phenomenon, though in different ways. The bewildering multiplicity of phenomena designated by the words phenomenon, semblance, appearance, mere appearance, cannot be disentangled unless the concept of the phenomenon is understood from the beginning as that which shows itself in itself. If in taking the concept of phenomenon this way we leave indefinite which entities we consider as phenomena, and leave it open whether what shows itself is an entity or rather some characteristic which an entity may have in its being, then we have merely arrived at the formal conception of phenomenon. If by that which shows itself we understand those entities which are accessible through the empirical intuition, in, let us say, Kant's sense, then the formal conception of phenomenon will indeed be legitimately employed. In this usage, phenomenon has the signification of the ordinary conception of phenomenon. But this ordinary conception is not the phenomenological conception. If we keep within the horizon of the Kantian problematic, we can give an illustration of what is conceived phenomenologically as a phenomenon with reservations as to other differences. For we may then say that that which already shows itself in the appearance as prior to the phenomenon, as ordinarily understood and as accompanying it in every case, can, even though it thus shows itself unthematically, be brought thematically to show itself, and what thus shows itself in itself the forms of the intuition, will be the phenomena of phenomenology. For manifestly, space and time must be able to show themselves in this way. They must be able to become phenomena if Kant is claiming to make a transcendental assertion grounded in the facts when he says that space is the a priori inside which of an ordering. If, however, the phenomenological conception of phenomenon is to be understood at all, regardless of how much closer we may come to determining the nature of that which shows itself, this presupposes inevitably that we must have an insight into the meaning of the formal conception of phenomenon and its legitimate employment in an ordinary signification. But before setting up our preliminary conception of phenomenology, we must also define the signification of logos, word, discourse, so as to make clear in what sense phenomenology can be a science of phenomena at all. B. The concept of the logos. In Plato and Aristotle, the concept of the logos, word, discourse, has many competing significations, with no basic signification positively taking the lead. In fact, however, this is only a semblance which will maintain itself as long as our interpretation is unable to grasp the basic signification properly in its primary content. If we say that the basic signification of logos is discourse, then this word-for-word translation will not be validated until we have determined what is meant by discourse itself. The real signification of discourse, which is obvious enough, gets constantly covered up by the later history of the word logos, and especially by the numerous and arbitrary interpretations which subsequent philosophy has provided. Logos gets translated, and this means that it is always getting interpreted, as reason, judgment, concept, definition, ground, or relationship. But how can discourse be so susceptible of modification that logos can signify all the things we have listed, and in good scholarly usage? Even if logos is understood in the sense of assertion, but of assertion as judgment, this seemingly legitimate translation may still miss the fundamental signification, especially if judgment is conceived in a sense taken over from some contemporary theory of judgment. Logos does not mean judgment, and it certainly does not mean this primarily, if one understands by judgment a way of binding something with something else, or the taking of a stand, whether by acceptance or by rejection. Logos, as discourse, means rather the same as delun, to show, to make clear, to make manifest what one is talking about in one's discourse. Aristotle has explicated this function of discourse more precisely as apophainestai. The logos lets something be seen phainestai, namely what the discourse is about. And it does so either for the one who is doing the talking, the medium, or for persons who are talking with one another, as the case may be. Discourse lets something be seen apo, from. That is, it lets us see something from the very thing which the discourse is about. In discourse, apophansis, so far as it is genuine, what is said, was geredet ist, is drawn from what the talk is about. So that discursive communication in what it says, in ihrem Gesagten, makes manifest what it is talking about, and thus makes this accessible to the other party. This is the structure of the logos as apophansis, discourse as making clear. This mode of making manifest in the sense of letting something be seen by pointing it out does not go with all kinds of discourse. Requesting euche, for instance, also makes manifest, but in a different way. When fully concrete, discoursing, letting something be seen, has the character of speaking, sprechens, vocal proclamation in words. The logos is phone, voice, utterance, and indeed phone metaphantasias, an utterance in which something is cited in each case. And only because the function of the logos as apophansis, discourse as making clear, lies in letting something be seen by pointing it out, can the logos have the structural form of synthesis. Here, synthesis does not mean a binding and linking together of representations, a manipulation of psychical occurrences where the problem arises of how these bindings, as something inside, agree with something physical outside. Here, the sun has a purely apophantical signification and means letting something be seen in its togetherness, beisammen, with something, letting it be seen as something. Furthermore, because the logos is a letting something be seen, it can therefore be true or false. But here everything depends on our steering clear of any conception of truth which is construed in the sense of agreement. This idea is by no means the primary one in the concept of aletheia, truth. The being true of the logos as alethuein, speak the truth, means that in legein, as apophainestai, talking is making clear, the entities of which one is talking must be taken out of their hiddenness. One must let them be seen as something unhidden, alethes, that is, they must be discovered. Similarly, being false, pseudestai, amounts to deceiving in the sense of covering up, verdecken, putting something in front of something in such a way as to let it be seen, and thereby passing it off as something which it is not. But because truth has this meaning, and because the logos is a definite mode of letting something be seen, the logos is just not the kind of thing that can be considered as the primary locus of truth. If, as has become quite customary nowadays, one defines truth as something that really pertains to judgment, and if one then invokes the support of Aristotle with this thesis, not only is this unjustified, but above all, the Greek conception of truth has been misunderstood. Aisthesis, perception, the sheer sensory perception of something, is true in the Greek sense, and indeed, more primordially than the logos which we have been discussing. Just as seeing aims at colours, aisthesis aims at its idea, things which are peculiar to it, those entities which are genuinely accessible only through it and for it. And to that extent this perception is always true. This means that seeing always discovers colours, and hearing always discovers sounds. Pure noein, perceiving, is the perception of the simplest determinate ways of being which entities as such may possess, and it perceives them just by looking at them. This noein, perceiving, is what is true in the purest and most primordial sense. That is to say, it merely discovers, and it does so in such a way that it can never cover up. This noein, perceiving, can never cover up. It can never be false. It can at worst remain a non-perceiving agnoein, not sufficing for straightforward and appropriate access. When something no longer takes the form of just letting something be seen, but is always harking back to something else to which it points, so that it lets something be seen as something, it thus acquires a synthesis structure, and with this it takes over the possibility of covering up. The truth of judgments, however, is merely the opposite of this covering up, a secondary phenomenon of truth with more than one kind of foundation. Both realism and idealism have, with equal thoroughness, missed the meaning of the Greek conception of truth, in terms of which only the possibility of something like a doctrine of ideas can be understood as philosophical knowledge. And because the function of the logos lies in merely letting something be seen, in letting entities be perceived, im vernehmen lassen des Seienden, logos can signify the reason, Vernunft. And because, moreover, logos is used not only with the signification of legein, showing, but also with that of legomenon, that which is exhibited as such, and because the latter is nothing else than the hupokemenon, that which is exhibited, what is underlying, which, as present at hand, already lies at the bottom, zum Grunde, of any procedure of addressing oneself to it or discussing it. Logos quae legomenon, that which is exhibited, means the ground, the ratio. And finally, because logos quae legomenon, that which is exhibited, can also signify that which, as something to which one addresses oneself, becomes visible in its relation to something in its relatedness, logos acquires the signification of relation and relationship. This interpretation of apophantical discourse may suffice to clarify the primary function of the logos. C. The preliminary conception of phenomenology. When we envisage concretely what we have set forth in our interpretation of phenomenon and logos, we're struck by an inner relationship between the things meant by these terms. The expression phenomenology may be formulated in Greek as legein ta phenomena, showing the phenomena, where legein means apophanestai, showing means making clear. Thus, phenomenology means apophanestai ta phenomena, making clear the phenomena, to let that which shows itself be seen from itself in the very way in which it shows itself from itself. This is the formal meaning of that branch of research which calls itself phenomenology. But here we are expressing nothing else than the maxim formulated above, to the things themselves. Thus, the term phenomenology is quite different in its meaning from expressions such as theology and the like. Those terms designate the objects of their respective sciences according to the subject matter which they comprise at the time, in ihrer jeweiligen Sachhaltigkeit. Phenomenology neither designates the object of its researches nor characterizes the subject matter thus comprised. The word merely informs us of the how with which what is to be treated in this science gets exhibited and handled. To have a science of phenomena means to grasp its objects in such a way that everything about them, which is up for discussion, must be treated by exhibiting it directly and demonstrating it directly. The expression descriptive phenomenology, which is at bottom tautological, has the same meaning. Here, description does not signify such a procedure as we find, let us say, in botanical morphology. The term has rather the sense of a prohibition, the avoidance of characterizing anything without such demonstration. The character of this description itself, the specific meaning of the logos, can be established first of all in terms of the thinghood, Sachheit, of what is to be described, that is to say, of what is to be given scientific definiteness as we encounter it phenomenally. The signification of phenomenon, as conceived both formally and in the ordinary manner, is such that any exhibiting of an entity as it shows itself in itself may be called phenomenology with formal justification. Now, what must be taken into account if the formal conception of phenomenon is to be deformalized into the phenomenological one, and how is this latter to be distinguished from the ordinary conception? What is it that phenomenology is to let us see? What is it that must be called a phenomenon in a distinctive sense? What is it that by its very essence is necessarily the theme whenever we exhibit something explicitly? Manifestly, it is something that proximally and for the most part does not show itself at all. It is something that lies hidden, in contrast to that which proximally and for the most part does show itself. But at the same time, it is something that belongs to what thus shows itself, and it belongs to it so essentially as to constitute its meaning and its ground. Yet that which remains hidden in an egregious sense, or which relapses and gets covered up again, or which shows itself only in disguise, is not just this entity or that, but rather the being of entities, as our previous observations have shown. This being can be covered up so extensively that it becomes forgotten, and no question arises about it or about its meaning. Thus, that which demands that it become a phenomenon, and which demands this in a distinctive sense and in terms of its own most content as a thing, is what phenomenology has taken into its grasp thematically as its object. Phenomenology is our way of access to what is to be the theme of ontology, and it is our way of giving it demonstrative precision. Only as phenomenology is ontology possible. In the phenomenological conception of phenomenon, what one has in mind, as that which shows itself, is the being of entities, its meaning, its modifications and derivatives. And this showing itself is not just any showing itself, nor is it some such thing as appearing. Least of all can the being of entities ever be anything such that behind it stands something else which does not appear. Behind the phenomena of phenomenology, there is essentially nothing else. On the other hand, what is to become a phenomenon can be hidden. And just because the phenomena are proximally and for the most part not given, there is need for phenomenology. Covered upness is the counterconcept to phenomenon. There are various ways in which phenomena can be covered up. In the first place, a phenomenon can be covered up in the sense that it is still quite undiscovered. It is neither known nor unknown. Moreover, a phenomenon can be buried over, verschüttet. This means that it has, at some point, been discovered but has deteriorated, verfiel, to the point of getting covered up again. This covering up can become complete. Or rather, and as a rule, what has been discovered earlier may still be visible, though only as a semblance. Yet so much semblance, so much being. This covering up as a disguising is both the most frequent and the most dangerous. For here the possibilities of deceiving and misleading are especially stubborn. Within a system, perhaps, those structures of being and their concepts, which are still available but veiled in their indigenous character, may claim their rights. For when they have been bound together constructively in a system, they present themselves as something clear, requiring no further justification, and thus can serve as the point of departure for a process of deduction. The covering up itself, whether in the sense of hiddenness, burying over, or disguise, has in turn two possibilities. There are coverings up which are accidental. There are also some which are necessary, grounded in what the thing discovered consists in. Der Bestandart des Entdeckten. Whenever a phenomenological concept is drawn from primordial sources, there is a possibility that it may degenerate if communicated in the form of an assertion. It gets understood in an empty way and is thus passed on, losing its indigenous character and becoming a free-floating thesis. Even in the concrete work of phenomenology itself, there lurks the possibility that what has been primordially within our grasp may become hardened so that we can no longer grasp it. And the difficulty of this kind of research lies in making it self-critical in a positive sense. The way in which being and its structures are encountered in the mode of phenomenon is one which must first of all be wrested from the objects of phenomenology. Thus the very point of departure, Ausgang, for our analysis, requires that it be secured by the proper method, just as much as does our access, Zugang, to the phenomenon, or our passage, Durchgang, through whatever is prevalently covering it up. The idea of grasping and explicating phenomena in a way which is original and intuitive, originären und intuitiven, is directly opposed to the naivete of a haphazard, immediate and unreflective beholding, schauen. Now that we have delimited our preliminary conception of phenomenology, the terms phenomenal and phenomenological can also be fixed in their signification. That which is given and explicable in the way the phenomenon is encountered is called phenomenal. This is what we have in mind when we talk about phenomenal structures. Everything which belongs to the species of exhibiting and explicating and which goes to make up the way of conceiving demanded by this research is called phenomenological. Because phenomena, as understood phenomenologically, are never anything but what goes to make up being, while being is in every case the being of some entity, we must first bring forward the entities themselves, if it is our aim that being should be laid bare. And we must do this in the right way. These entities must likewise show themselves with the kind of access which genuinely belongs to them. And in this way, the ordinary conception of phenomenon becomes phenomenologically relevant. If our analysis is to be authentic, its aim is such that the prior task of assuring ourselves phenomenologically of that entity, which is to serve as our example, has already been prescribed as our point of departure. With regard to its subject matter, phenomenology is the science of the being of entities, ontology. In explaining the tasks of ontology, we found it necessary that there should be a fundamental ontology, taking as its theme that entity which is ontologico-ontically distinctive, Dasein, in order to confront the cardinal problem, the question of the meaning of being in general. Our investigation itself will show that the meaning of phenomenological description as a method lies in interpretation. The logos of the phenomenology of Dasein has the character of a hermeneuein, to interpret, through which the authentic meaning of being and also those basic structures of being which Dasein itself possesses are made known to Dasein's understanding of being. The phenomenology of Dasein is a hermeneutic in the primordial signification of this word, where it designates this business of interpreting. But to the extent that by uncovering the meaning of being and the basic structures of Dasein in general we may exhibit the horizon for any further ontological study of those entities which do not have the character of Dasein, this hermeneutic also becomes a hermeneutic in the sense of working out the conditions on which the possibility of any ontological investigation depends. And finally, to the extent that Dasein, as an entity with the possibility of existence, has ontological priority over every other entity, hermeneutic, as an interpretation of Dasein's being, has the third and specific sense of an analytic of the existentiality of existence, and this is the sense which is philosophically primary. Then, so far as this hermeneutic works out Dasein's historicality ontologically, as the ontological condition for the possibility of historiology, it contains the roots of what can be called hermeneutic only in a derivative sense. The methodology of those humane sciences which are historiological in character. Being, as the basic theme of philosophy, is no class or genus of entities, yet it pertains to every entity. Its universality is to be sought higher up. Being and the structure of being lie beyond every entity and every possible character which an entity may possess. Being is the transcendens pure and simple, and the transcendence of Dasein's being is distinctive in that it implies the possibility and the necessity of the most radical individuation. Every disclosure of being as the transcendens is transcendental knowledge, phenomenological truth. The disclosedness of being is veritas transcendentalis. Ontology and phenomenology are not two distinct philosophical disciplines among others. These terms characterize philosophy itself with regard to its object and its way of treating that object. Philosophy is universal phenomenological ontology and takes its departure from the hermeneutic of Dasein, which, as an analytic of existence, has made fast the guiding line for all philosophical inquiry at the point where it arises and to which it returns. The following investigation would not have been possible if the ground had not been prepared by Edmund Husserl, with whose Logische Untersuchungen phenomenology first emerged. Our comments on the preliminary conception of phenomenology have shown that what is essential in it does not lie in its actuality as a philosophical movement, Richtung. Higher than actuality stands possibility. We can understand phenomenology only by seizing upon it as a possibility. With regard to the awkwardness and inelegance of expression in the analyses to come, we may remark that it is one thing to give a report in which we tell about entities, but another to grasp entities in their being. For the latter task we lack not only most of the words, but above all the grammar. If we may allude to some earlier researchers on the analysis of being, incomparable on their own level, we may compare the ontological sections of Plato's Parmenides, or the fourth chapter of the seventh book of Aristotle's Metaphysics, with a narrative section from Thucydides. We can then see the altogether unprecedented character of those formulations which were imposed upon the Greeks by their philosophers, and where our powers are essentially weaker, and where, moreover, the area of being to be disclosed is ontologically far more difficult than that which was presented to the Greeks. The harshness of our expression will be enhanced, and so will the minuteness of detail with which our concepts are formed. Section 8. Design of the treatise. The question of the meaning of being is the most universal and the emptiest of questions, but at the same time it is possible to individualize it very precisely for any particular Dasein. If we are to arrive at the basic concept of being and to outline the ontological conceptions which it requires, and the variations which it necessarily undergoes, we need a clue which is concrete. We shall proceed towards the concept of being by way of an interpretation of a certain special entity, Dasein, in which we shall arrive at the horizon for the understanding of being and for the possibility of interpreting it. The universality of the concept of being is not belied by the relatively special character of our investigation. But this very entity, Dasein, is in itself historical, so that its ownmost ontological elucidation necessarily becomes an historiological interpretation. Accordingly, our treatment of the question of being branches out into two distinct tasks, and our treatise will thus have two parts. Part 1, the interpretation of Dasein in terms of temporality, and the explication of time as the transcendental horizon for the question of being. Part 2, basic features of a phenomenological destruction of the history of ontology, with the problematic of temporality as our clue. Part 1 has three divisions. 1. The preparatory fundamental analysis of Dasein. 2. Dasein and temporality. 3. Time and being. Part 2 likewise has three divisions. 1. Kant's doctrine of schematism and time as a preliminary stage in a problematic of temporality. 2. The ontological foundation of Descartes' Cogito Sum, and how the medieval ontology has been taken over into the problematic of the res cogitans. 3. Aristotle's essay on time as providing a way of discriminating the phenomenal basis and the limits of ancient ontology. Part 1. The interpretation of Dasein in terms of temporality and the explication of time as the transcendental horizon for the question of being. Division 1. Preparatory fundamental analysis of Dasein. In the question about the meaning of being, what is primarily interrogated is those entities which have the character of Dasein. The preparatory existential analytic of Dasein must, in accordance with its peculiar character, be expounded in outline and distinguished from other kinds of investigation which seem to run parallel. Adhering to the procedure which we have fixed upon for starting our investigation, we must lay bare a fundamental structure in Dasein: being in the world. In the interpretation of Dasein, this structure is something a priori. It is not pieced together, but is primordially and constantly a whole. It affords us, however, various ways of looking at the items which are constitutive for it. The whole of this structure always comes first. But if we keep this constantly in view, these items as phenomena will be made to stand out, and thus we shall have as objects for analysis the world in its worldhood, being in the world as being with and being oneself, and being in as such. By analysis of this fundamental structure, the being of Dasein can be indicated provisionally. Its existential meaning is care. Chapter 1. Exposition of the task of a preparatory analysis of Dasein. Section 9. The theme of the analytic of Dasein. We are ourselves the entities to be analyzed. The being of any such entity is, in each case, mine. These entities, in their being, comport themselves towards their being. As entities with such being, they are delivered over to their own being. Being is that which is an issue for every such entity. This way of characterizing Dasein has a double consequence. The essence, Wesen, of this entity lies in its to be, zu sein. Its being what it is, was sein, essentia, must, so far as we can speak of it at all, be conceived in terms of its being, existentia. But here our ontological task is to show that when we choose to designate the being of this entity as existence, existence, this term does not and cannot have the ontological signification of the traditional term